Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Education, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Laura Kelly, a host on the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Ariana Manguel Figueroa, the author of the new book, Knowing Silence, How Children Talk About Immigration Status in School. Ariana, welcome to the show. Could you tell us a little about yourself?
Yes, thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here to join you and your listeners in this conversation. I am an associate professor at the City University of New York Graduate Center, and I'm a professor in two PhD programs, Urban Education and Latin American, Iberian, and Latino Cultures. Prior to becoming a professor, I was a New York City public school teacher of English as a Second Language and Spanish.
Fantastic. So let's go ahead and talk about the book. This is a book about how young children talk about immigration status at school, and specifically how undocumented students or students from mixed status families negotiate that during their education. Early in the book, it's important to you to argue that children are not so naive as some have thought them to be regarding immigration status. You write, "Childhood innocence is far from universal." What school of thought are you trying to correct here, and why is that important to the project?
Thank you for that provocative question. As a former elementary and middle school and high school teacher, as an ethnographer of education, and as someone who has spent a lot of time with mixed status families, so families in which some members are U.S. born and are U.S. born citizens, others are not born in the U.S. and don't have authorized permission to be in the country and so therefore are undocumented, and also include members in different stages of applying for or losing authorization to be in the U.S. Having spent many, many years in those families, I realized and learned from children themselves, from young people and from parents, that the conversation about the realities and the lived experience of living with different immigration statuses is very present. And I observed ethnographically that children have multiple ways of communicating how much they know. And so over time, I've been arguing for and developing ways of working methodologically, of intervening theoretically, as you said, Laura, into the idea that children are innocent of categories that we as researchers or as educators consider adult appropriate categories. And so I'm intervening, I think, in a number of different conversations. The first is a more adult-centered ideology around what it is to know, and that we tend to count knowledge that is articulable, that is made explicit by the people that we research and research alongside. And so part of that, I think, is a pervasive sort of ideology in education and in parenting and in the U.S. I think there are some discipline-specific methodologies and orientations that predispose us to that as well. I think that a qualitative designed research that depends on self-report, on interview methods in which an interview respondent has to be able to say, this is what citizenship is, or this is how it has shaped me, or this is when I came to know, limits our ability to hear what young children have to say and how they might say it. And there's a body of literature that I admire a tremendous amount from the fields of educational psychology and from sociology that has tended to show that has made important interventions that citizenship is a dynamic construct. And then it's something that shifts across the lifespan, both the actual having or lacking of U.S. citizenship, but also the understanding of what it means to be a citizen. And so I'm speaking to my colleagues in those disciplines, and I'm drawing very much on their work, on the work of Carola Suarez Orozco, who so generously, you know, so has supported and endorsed the book, on the work of Roberto Gonzalez, who I've researched with and worked with in the past on a multi-year project that we called Peace. And I'm speaking to those colleagues to draw both on the important interventions they've made and to draw our attention to the particular ways in which children make sense of and talk about what citizenship means to them in their lives at home and at school.
So you were intentional in your description about why you wanted to work with 10 and 11-year-olds. And I have also been working with fourth graders myself this year, and I can confirm that it is very special of a time. So tell us what's special about that age of participants for understanding the questions that you wanted to explore.
Yes, thank you. I think that one piece, Laura, is that they are at a critical juncture in their educational trajectory. So in New York City, elementary school ends typically in fifth grade, and then students go on to middle school in sixth grade. And precisely because of the research and the scholarship I was citing earlier, I was keen to understand how citizenship ends up sort of surfacing for young people and for children in educational transitions. And so my eye or my attention went towards thinking about an educational transition that predated adolescence and young adulthood. So there was that. In terms of 10 and 11-year-olds in particular, they are still in a very sort of playful moment developmentally, but they are also attuned in really specific ways, in the case of children in mixed status families, to the socio-political context in which they're growing up. And so a focus on that age permitted both a listening in to children in their own terms and also a grappling with how they are making sense of a future and their educational trajectory and their responsibility to family and community in very specific ways. The other thing I would say, to be quite frank, is, as you know, ethnographically and in terms of research, there's also a fair amount of serendipity that is involved in finding a particular group of people to work with. And so I had the support of very generous educators and school leaders who welcomed me into this one particular school. And it so happened that the population of young people I wanted to work with were clustered in this one particular fifth grade classroom that year. And so it became a joy and an honor to spend time with all of them.
Serendipity is also how I found my fourth graders.
Yeah.
So to collect your data, you had students wear iPods as they moved throughout their days in fifth grade. What was it like to get undocumented and mixed status families to consent to this level of hyper documentation of their days?
Yes, thank you. And thank you for framing it in that way. One of the scholars whose work I draw on heavily in the book, her name is Doctora Aurora Chang, theorizes this very concept of hyper documentation, that in fact, for families in which immigration documentation and authorization is lacking, family members pursue other forms of documentation, other forms of papers to sort of shore up a sense of belonging and worthiness in this country. And so that often comes in the forms of honor rolls and diplomas and leases and home ownership and so on. And so it's very interesting that you pose the question in light of that concept. In terms of the particular methodology of working with children and families and centering attention to children's talk, the iPod became an important tool to be able to record talk that unfolded throughout the course of everyday life. And the children and the families themselves were the ones who helped to really amplify the way that we worked around questions of informed consent in this project. So, of course, there were months of developing trust and relationships and a presence in the school community and in the particular focal classroom that preceded my sending home consent forms or doing any kind of recording whatsoever. And after those many, many months, I, you know, with the approval of course, the IRB from my, you know, higher ed institution and from the school district, it should, you know, be stated. So these very, you know, important and intense layers of ethical consideration and access gaining, I gave out consent forms in the traditional way to be signed by parents and by the teacher, and assent forms for the children themselves to offer their own permission in a child appropriate way, and received all of those and you know, began the process of recording. And within a week of recording, the focal children, right, there were six within a classroom of 24, and at any given moment, four of those were, you know, had the opportunity to wear the iPods throughout the day. Very quickly, within about a week, the children started to tell me when and how they wanted to wear the iPods. So it went very quickly from a sort of generalized informed consent, like, yes, I will do this as part of this project, to a much more nuanced informed consent, which was, or assent in the case of the children, which sometimes went something like, Miss Ariaga, I said a secret at 10 a.m. this morning on the recorder, and so I don't want you to use that. So a revoking of consent, right, to analyze what had been recorded. Or sometimes went a different way, which would sound more like, well, Miss Ariana, we're going to lunch now, and I don't want to wear the iPod there. So can I take it off? And of course, my response was yes. And so, you know, they were my own local IRB board, in a sense. And they started to say, well, the terms of the informed assent that we've given you actually aren't sufficient for the complexity of this project. And so here's how we want to negotiate recording. And so, you know, I responded to that, and I honored, of course, when and where they wanted to wear them. And about a week or so after that event, so within the first month of this recording process, they started to say, the children who were wearing them started to say, we want to hear what it is you're recording. Like, what did you get, right? What did I say at 10:30, or what did I say when I put it back on in science class? And so I worked with the school leadership, the teachers, the parents, and the focal children to create a one-day-a-week after-school program, essentially, where I would share the recordings and have the children develop protocols with me and analyze them together. And so it's a long but I think important explanation, Laura, of how informed consent looked in relation to recording children's talk, but also really importantly, how it was the children themselves who helped to make that process more dynamic and more empowering for them.
So I'll pause here and note for listeners that the early chapters of the book have very extensive detail about the methods and the ethics of working with these students. And so a grad student who's exploring qualitative methods may want to check that out, or anyone who teaches qualitative methods or research ethics should really look into this book as an example of being really thoughtful about that. You just mentioned your after-school grupo de análisis that the girls initiated. Can you tell us, so you did tell us what they wanted out of that. Can you tell us what came out of that group as far as contributing to the research project?
Yeah, thank you for that question. And thank you for that invitation to think amply about audience and how the book might be used. I agree. Yes, the grupo de análisis was really, really an important part of sustaining the 10-year project, what became really a decade-long process of acompañamiento, or my walking alongside this focal group of young people. So that initial phase, you're right, in fifth grade was very much about listening to and beginning to analyze the audio together, intergenerationally and collaboratively. And then in fifth grade, the children graduated from elementary school and went on to middle school, and they asked if we could continue meeting. And so we continued meeting. I continued that same structure again with all of the support of the administration and the teachers, parents, and the young people themselves to continue returning actually to the elementary school once they had graduated to pursue additional analysis. And very much what happened was that then with the new experiences of middle school, the group became more than a member check. It became an opportunity for me to provide mentorship and for them to stay connected in the midst of so much change. And so that model of our continuing to meet to talk both about the project and who they were as children, but also how those themes that we discussed at 10 and 11, how they persisted throughout their adolescence and their education, that became the sustaining sort of activity for us to remain connected and for me to shift out of researcher and into a more mentor role. And for those who will read the book, you know, the chapters really focus primarily on that fifth grade year, fifth and sixth grade, but the conclusion and the afterword bring the book into the present tense. And so it's precisely because of the young people's desire for connection, both to the topic of the project, but also to one another and to me, that we were able to really remain connected over a decade and then continue co-writing and collaborating into the present tense.
That was really rewarding to get to the end and see them writing in their own words and co-authoring with you as they were finishing high school and thinking about what comes next for them. So you opened chapter 3 with this question. So I'm just going to read your own question back to you and invite you to share some findings and analysis from the project about it so listeners can get an idea about what kind of data is shared in the book. So the question that you wrote was, how are the girls' responses to classroom assignments and activities informed by what they know about citizenship and what they want others to know or not know?
Thank you. Yes, this chapter and the heart of the book, sort of those core two chapters of the book, really do seek to integrate an understanding of how children participate and act in school within the context of the curriculum, the pedagogy, and then the broader national context of immigration policy and schooling. And so in this chapter, I explore, and in the subsequent one, chapter 4 as well, I explore the ways in which the children perceive of and respond to invitations to discuss their personal lives in school and to study immigration itself as a topic of study. And so what I found is that this is really where the theorization of speech and silence arises, because it's possible in public school classrooms to be very focused and very predisposed to thinking about what it is that children say explicitly and what they communicate to us. And it's something that I'm sure you can imagine, and many of your listeners can imagine, that silence actually can be kind of golden in a school classroom, in a classroom of 24 children. When someone doesn't speak, it isn't always seen as a source of concern. It might actually alleviate or be helpful or help to, you know, keep the larger classroom flow positive and productive. But what I found was that the children in this project were interpreting school documents, school assignments, school subject matter in ways that they either found inviting and produced the kinds of connections between home and school that the teachers hoped for, or they found those very same kinds of questions alienating and risky, depending on their own immigration status. And so out of that, children then made a set of decisions about when to share or disclose and when to be silent and withhold. And that our understanding of those withholdings, in a way, can really come by through a kind of listening that I was privileged to be able to do as an ethnographer. Because I was in possession of those school-based recordings, I could listen over and over to perceive when children were experiencing a kind of anxiety or silence based upon the subject matter in ways that teachers might not perceive. And so my hope then is that what the book makes visible is both those incredible moments of expression and also those significant moments of silence that might go unnoticed. So one very short example is that, sometimes activities that were meant to enlist connection between home and school, very much in these important traditions that I think you and I have been trained in and that we impart to our students, a funds of knowledge approach, a culturally sustaining approach, a culturally relevant approach to teaching. Sometimes those invitations to connect cultures across home and school may have unintended consequences for children when in schools we tend to use the language of citizenship as metaphorical, as about being about participation and engagement, and where in homes the language of citizenship is really quite literal and about the potential for detention or deportation. And so I hope that those chapters are an invitation to think about children's behavior within a broader sociopolitical context and can help teachers to reflect in a praxis-oriented way around how it is that we enlist and make visible culture in the classroom.
You write that the 1982 Supreme Court case, Plyler versus Doe, which established the right of undocumented students to attend K-12 public schools in the U.S., has produced domains of silence, or an effective don't ask, don't tell policy in regard to immigration status at school. What do you think we should have instead? What would it look like for educators to advocate for undocumented and mixed status families?
Thank you for that. I do. I want to say that I think it's an important and really significant ruling. And I draw on the work of legal scholars like Justin Driver, like Michael Olivas, and others who argued for the importance of Plyler in setting a precedent that children, regardless of immigration status, have access, equal access to the public institutions in this country, namely education. And so I think that's an important, and that it's actually preempted other attempts locally at the state level and federally to undermine those rights. And so I think that is an important thing to start with. And I think that the dilemma of protecting students' rights by invisibilizing them has led to the kind of professional silences that I hope the book can help us to break through a bit. I think one of the things that it's done is it's created sort of in arguing for children's innocence and therefore their need to be protected, it has contributed to this notion of children's ignorance, because we kind of bracket all questions of immigration at the schoolhouse door. And we've had less practice, I think, as a profession, thinking about how immigration and education actually intersect in the lives of kids and families. And so I think one of the really important things, given the numbers, the demographic numbers, for example, that in 2021, more than 16.7 million people lived in mixed status households in the United States. And as of 2018, 4.4 million of children, 4.4 million children under the age of 18 lived with at least one undocumented parent. Like, so in light of the numbers, the changing demographics, and even more recently, again, a shift in demographics as migrant families have come from the world over, I think we have a responsibility to reimagine that all of our classrooms are mixed status classrooms. I think that one of the ways that we can better serve children from mixed status families is to assume that they are present in our classrooms. And so to think about, as we're transmitting information, be it at the secondary to college transition level, as we're talking about FAFSA, as we're talking about college admissions, when we're thinking in middle school and high school and talking about internships and employment opportunities, when we're at the elementary school level thinking about curriculum and the books that we put in our libraries and the ways that we teach about immigration, if we assume that everyone in that classroom is impacted currently, not simply in a historical sense of immigration as heritage, but immigration as lived contemporarily, then I think we might be able to shift the assumptions we make about who is in the room and what information they need to have. And the reason I think this really matters in relation to Plyler is because since we as educators, for good reason, don't ask and we don't tell, then the onus falls on the children and families themselves to disclose to us what their immigration status is when they're pursuing educational opportunities. And, you know, from the book and from the research cited in the book about how risky it is for children to disclose and for families to disclose at this their immigration status, I think it's incumbent upon us as educators to provide ample information that provides different trajectories and different ways into learning and discussion that does not require children, young people, and adults to make those calculated decisions and take those risks to seek the very educational opportunities that we hope to extend to them.
Thank you for your detailed responses to all of these questions. Is there anything else that you would like to say about the book or about young children navigating immigration status at school?
Thank you. I would love to add one other thing, Laura, which is that I am especially proud that the afterword of the book has been co-authored by myself and four of the original participants in the study. And I'm proud of it for a number of reasons, because it is an opportunity to model and to show ways of writing and collaborating with the very participants who become then the leaders and the researchers in their own project. I'm proud because it's an example of a place where, instead of bracketing the dilemmas that came up in the research, when and how to disclose, we found a way of writing in a way that allowed us to make that the center of the project and to come to consensus, which we articulated in the very afterword, about how to share and when and how and why. And finally, I would say that it's an outcome of the book that also shows how children who then become young adults carry the concerns, preoccupations, and also the incredible strengths and survival and the dreams and the hopes that they have and they continue to articulate over a lifespan. And so my hope is that readers will experience this as their own process of accompanying the young people and myself on this decade of learning together.
Fantastic. So we always end by asking our authors what they're working on now or what you're curious about and what's catching your attention at this point.
Yes. Well, I would say I am attuned to all of the ways in which our students and my colleagues are thinking about ways of breaking silence around the topics that they care so deeply about at this moment, and whether that is through writing, through protests, through conversation. I remain in deep admiration of communities coming together to advocate for what they believe is just. And so as a professor, I'm thinking deeply about what my role is in those movements for social justice locally and globally. And I am in the moment of concluding a beautiful 5-year trajectory, so 5 years within the 10 years of collaboration with community members, students, faculty at the CUNY Initiative for Immigration and Education. We're developing and continuing to disseminate the resources we've been building around questions of immigration and education in New York State. And I hope that readers will join us there and be able to use those resources locally as well.
All right. Well, thank you for sharing that and letting us know about those resources. I'll remind listeners that we've been talking about the book Knowing Silence, How Children Talk About Immigration Status in School. It is out now, so we encourage people to check it out. And we want to thank you so much for coming on the show today. We really enjoyed this.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.